Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. Diane's recovering from a voice treatment and will be back in this chair soon. West African countries, most especially Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, have issued a clarion call to the rest of the world for help. The Ebola virus has claimed the lives of at least 2,400 people and threatens many thousands more without swift international intervention. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University, Dr. Miatudula Malonga, formerly with the World Bank. And by phone from Atlanta, we have Betsy McKay of the Wall Street Journal, and from Dallas, Dr. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota. Welcome to you all. Good morning. With me here as well in the studio, Dr. Rajiv Shah. He's the administrator of USAID, and later this morning, right from this broadcast, he will be leaving to join the president to fly to Atlanta for this announcement on the latest U.S. initiative, which was reported this morning. Dr. Shah, welcome, and give us an update on what the president's going to say.
Well, thank you, Steve, and I'm so glad you're doing this piece today because the Ebola crisis in West Africa is extraordinarily important. The president has noted that with more than 4,000 cases and more than 2,000 deaths, this is a national security priority. And the United States government has been focused on this since at least March, having committed and spent $175 million to support a broad range of activities in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, and throughout the region. This has been the largest deployment to date of the Centers for Disease Control personnel for any international epidemic, and we have 28 agencies represented on the ground in West Africa working together to support the response.
And what specifically will you be doing?
But today the president is going to specifically announce a historic expansion of this effort, and it will focus on ensuring that the entire international community has the resources, capabilities, logistics support in place to mount a response commensurate with the challenge and turn the tide on this epidemic. Specifically, we will be deploying significant military capabilities for command and control, for logistics and operations, for supply chain management, and importantly, to help build out Ebola treatment units in Liberia and throughout the region. And that will be important. One of the most important things we'll be doing is establishing training capabilities so that we can greatly accelerate the number of local healthcare workers that get trained in the very important and very significant protocols required to provide services and support to likely patients without infecting oneself.
Now, I noticed in an interview you did with NPR over the weekend, you talked about the recruitment process you're going through to get healthcare workers to join this effort, but also that there are inhibitions here. I mean, this is dangerous work, and other healthcare workers have been infected. Tell us about who these workers are going to be, who are going to be joining you. If folks are listening, can they volunteer, and what precautions are you putting in place to protect them?
Well, first I'll speak to the precautions. The Department of Defense, working with USAID and CDC, will be building a 25-bed hospital in Monrovia, specifically to provide very high quality, very controlled treatment to healthcare workers who get exposed. This, coupled with our emerging capability to expand access to medical evacuation and the partnership of other countries to take patients if necessary, will allow us to say to healthcare workers that if you go and you're part of this response, we can vouch for your safety as much as is possible. As a result, we hope to see hundreds of critical care health workers, medical professionals flood into West Africa right now. And just in the last few weeks, we've asked workers to go to usaid.gov to register there, and then we can assign you to a partner like International Medical Corps, Partners in Health, or others, Medicine
Sans Frontières. So listeners who want to join can go to that website.
They absolutely can. We've had a few
hundred
already.
And we'll post that on our own website here at WAMU so that the folks who are listening will have a way to do that.
Go Excellent. Ahead. And I think this makes the important point. Today's announcement of a very significant military deployment in order to enable the effectiveness of a global response is coordinated and conducted with our international partners. The Department of Defense capacity to build out training capability and support for healthcare workers will allow the African Union to be successful with its pledge of more than 100 healthcare workers that are going from all over Africa to West Africa. It will allow other countries in Europe and Latin America and Asia that have made important commitments to send healthcare workers to plug into a coordinated, well-run system to tackle this disease.
Now, you said, Dr. Shaw, that the U.S. government's been focusing on this problem since March, and you mentioned the resources you've allocated. But Betsy McKay, who will be on this program in just a minute from the Wall Street Journal, just this morning wrote in the journal that a lot of health professionals think that the response has been too slow and that this epidemic has, to quote one, has spiraled out of control. How do you answer the criticisms that the response has been too slow?
Well, I'll say that I'm a medical doctor by training, and the reality is that we are fully committed to this effort. And the disease has accelerated. As it's gone from hundreds to thousands of cases, we have seen the needs and the requirements on the ground go up exponentially. And that's why in just the last several weeks, we've delivered more than 130,000 personal protective equipment kits, more than 5,000 body bags, WHO certified body bags, so that people who unfortunately die from this disease can have safe and dignified and rapid burials or cremation without infecting others. This is an all hands on deck effort. And the very reason we're calling in these significant military resources is to try to match the scale of the crisis.
But were you surprised at how rapidly this spread? Because previous Ebola outbreaks have not been nearly as contagious, not nearly as widespread, and it's entered urban areas, particularly in Liberia. So with the internet, you know, the international community caught unaware of how rapidly this would spread?
Well, certainly no one's has seen this before. Mm-hmm. This is a epidemic of Ebola that far outstrips anything that has been experienced previously, both in the transmission and in the mortality rate, and in particular in the urban contacts and the risks and rapid transmission that that has led to in Monrovia and other urban areas. I will say this is also the largest response that's been mounted in any infectious disease control effort, and it will require the kind of massive logistics capability that the Department of Defense will bring, not just to enable USAID or CDC or U.S. government partners to be more effective, although that will be critical, but to enable other countries to put more resources in and more capacity. And we've worked with the European Union. They've announced a $180 million commitment. We're working with countries all over the world to get healthcare workers in to run and provide services in these Ebola treatment units. And ultimately, the success of this will rely on thousands of Liberians, of members of the West African community themselves getting trained and being part of the response.
Now, one of the things you stressed, Dr. Shaw, was that this is a national security issue for the United States. Some listeners might say, why would an epidemic, even one of this power in West Africa, threaten American security? What's the connection you're making and the connection the president will be making later today?
Well, first and foremost, as part of our strategy, we have an explicit commitment to keep the disease contained and to allow other countries in the region to have the preparedness and capacity to prevent a similar outbreak in those areas. As Dr. Tom Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control has highlighted, there is not an immediate risk of Ebola coming to the United States, but certainly we're going to do everything we can to keep this contained and to prevent the risk of that happening, and this is part of that picture. I also would note that these are low-income countries that are relatively fragile, and the capacity of any country to see a 10 or 20% reduction in its economic activity overnight, to see companies like mining companies just stop employing people, people no longer going to stores, food becoming scarce, water becoming scarce. These are the kinds of consequences that can lead to rapid societal breakdown. After which, by the way, the cost to Americans will be much, much, much more significant given the region and the intended threats. So this is an effort to get ahead of that. We are providing food, we're providing water, we're providing financial support. We're working with the World Bank and the IMF to unlock hundreds of millions of dollars. So this is genuinely an international and coordinated effort.
You know, obviously you're here to talk about Ebola, but as you talk, I hear echoes of the explanation and the argument for opposing ISIS in the Middle East, that the connection being that if states become unstable and descend into chaos, that even though it's far away, America's national interest gets engaged in trying to contain that chaos.
I think that's right. And what I would say here is that we know how to contain this disease. Contrary to kind of public reporting, you know, the disease it spreads often, but not as easily as some others. And by taking relatively simple precautions, but in a rigorous way, families can protect themselves, communities can protect themselves, and countries can get over the hump. And so part of the announcement the president's making today is also a large-scale messaging and communications campaign so that every Liberian family, for example, has access to better hygiene and can take on the behaviors to protect themselves even as they seek Ebola treatment units for people who are suspect in probable cases.
But a final question before you go to join the president. What's your sense that these countries will be receptive to this massive outside intervention of American military and from other countries?
Well, the United States State Department and all of us have been deeply engaged with country leadership. I was on the phone three times in the last week with President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who absolutely welcomes
of
this
Liberia.
Effort. Of Liberia, yeah. Who welcomes this effort, called for it, and actually is also saying that ultimately, this will enable Liberians themselves to stand up and get over this crisis.
Dr. Rajiv Shah, he's the administrator of USAID. He's joining the president today for a major announcement on Ebola in Atlanta. I'm Steve Roberts. We'll be right back with more guests and comments. Thank you for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, our subject this hour. The American response will be announced by the president shortly of a major new response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And we were joined by Dr. Rajiv Shah, the USAID administrator. He's now left to join the president. And I have four other experts with me, Dr. Mia Tudela Malonga, who is formerly with the World Bank, and also with me here in the studio, Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University on the phone, Betsy McKay of the Wall Street Journal, and from Dallas, Dr. Michael Oosterholm of the University of Minnesota. Welcome to you all. Thank you for joining us here on the Diane Rehm Show. You, of course, can join us as well, 1-800-433-8850. Email is drshow@wamu.org. Michael Oosterholm, I want to start with you and pick up on something that Dr. Shah said, that this outbreak seems to be different. We've had Ebola outbreaks since 1976, but he seemed to indicate that not only was this one different, but that the world community of health experts were surprised at its ferocity. Give us your take on that.
Well, thank you. First of all, it's always easy to be an armchair quarterback, and so could we have identified that this was going to happen months ago? I think we should have and could have, relative to understanding the developing world and the population changes there, but we didn't. This is very different, and in fact, I wrote a piece in the Washington Post on August 1st talking about why the virus hadn't changed, Africa had changed, and that's what made this different. This is really the first urban outbreak of Ebola we've had, where you have very large population centers with a lack of access to adequate health care, poor sanitation, crowding, and that's very different than trying to work on an Ebola outbreak in largely rural Africa, where it's a much more limited population, limited contacts, and the ability to do follow-up is much greater. So this one clearly is different in that regard, and that could be said for any developing world city around the world. Something like this could happen if it were to emerge.
Now, you also have been quoted as saying, while you mentioned that the Ebola virus has not changed, that there are concerns that it might change and might mutate. And as you point out, now it's, at this stage, it's transmitted, as Dr. Shaw said, through bodily fluids, which is relatively easy to contain. But if it mutates into a gene that's airborne, that becomes far more contagious and far more dangerous. What's the science now? How big a threat is that?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's just back up and make it clear that, you know, when you look at modes of transmission of any agent, they can change occasionally. Influenza is a good example. It's a virus that goes from being that of an enteric virus or in the stool of ducks to one that is a respiratory transmitted agent in humans. So sometimes with mutations, these can change. The concern around this one is, you might say theoretical, but also real. We've actually had respiratory transmission of Ebola virus from subhuman primates or monkeys to each other, from pigs to monkeys. And even in one outbreak investigation back in the mid-90s, the summary report actually from the CDC said it couldn't conclude if some of the cases could have been from fomite contact or respiratory. So I don't want us to focus on that. I think it's one that is surely an important issue if this virus continues to pass through many, many humans. Remember, up until this outbreak, we'd only had documented about 2,000 cases of Ebola virus infection in the past 40 years. Clearly, there been more we missed, but not a lot. We've more than doubled, quadrupled the amount of transmission that occurs in humans with this virus in the last 4 months
right.
than we did in the previous 100 and some years. So I think that that's where we're concerned, because with those transmissions occur more mutations that could happen. I think the focus should be we got to respond, but the last thing we want to have happen is give this virus an opportunity to actually create a particular strain that could more
right.
readily be transmitted by the respiratory route.
Now, Dr. Goodman, you study this problem from the medical point of view as well. One of the articles I read said that the virus has the high ground now. Is that true? Is the medical knowledge, the medical response fallen behind?
Well, I think it is true that the medical and public health response has fallen behind, but I don't think the virus has the high ground.
Mm-hmm.
At least it shouldn't have it for long. And, you know, I really welcome the president's announcement and a massive influx of resources, and I hope other countries, some of which have stepped up and others of which need to do that, follow. You know, as Michael said, unless this virus were to change, we know how to control it. Other countries have controlled smaller outbreaks. This is different. It's larger and involves urban areas. It involves countries that have infrastructure that is not set up to contain this. So in that sense, we've allowed the virus to get the high ground, but that's ground that should be able to be reclaimed. We know the public health measures of isolation. I believe that medical care can be improved and save many individuals with Ebola virus, even without experimental therapies. So that also will help.
If the intervention is prompt enough and efficient
enough. If people believe that medical care can help them, so they seek it, and if those facilities are set up to provide it, another reason why DOD helping set up healthcare facilities, I think, will be really, really helpful.
And I want to bring in Dr. Malunga, because you have long experience here. I know that you were in Africa in the first outbreaks of Ebola back in the 70s. This question of the willingness of these African countries to accept the outside help, the suspiciousness of doctors and treatments, the burial rituals which can help spread the disease. How ready are the countries in Africa for this initiative the president is announcing today?
Thank you. Let me refer to my experience. because I was indeed in the first, I was part of the team that dealt with the disease, the first outbreak in Yamboko in DRC. I was part of the team that named the virus, so I can talk. All the fears that we have about the response from African communities are actually false, because I think most of the problems are created by by the experts that we are. What has worked so far is when you go there with an open mind and you equip local communities with knowledge without creating hysteria or panic, just knowledge, you give them adequate facts. And then you engage in a dialogue, in a two-way communication with communities, you will be surprised. African communities will be willing to accept you. And they are going to even come with their own strategies how to deal with the disease. Because I've seen in just one month in northern Zaire, DRC, a change in the practices that we thought were impossible to change, like the burial. In just one month, people completely changed the way they were treating dead bodies.
And what's the key to doing that? Is it a question of trust?
The key is, one, information, and two, communication. And communication is only possible when you trust the community. When you trust communities, communities are going to trust you back. Huh. So the mistake we are doing now in West Africa is coming there as outsider. When I say outsider, I don't only mean Americans or European comings, but even the national authorities, they are seen as outsider. So the communities, local communities, they don't trust them.
Right.
So they are going to hide the patients, and then when they come to the hospital, they come there to die. That also increases the suspicion against the health centers.
And of course, epidemiology requires information. It requires the ability of people to be frank about their contacts, so the epidemiologists can do their work and track down the potential spread of the virus. Right.
Exactly.
I mean, it's absolutely. Epidemiology requires that kind of information.
Exactly, but we are not following the reality. We are behaving like people don't know. People are stupid. They need us to come there to take care of their problems. I think if we create trust, then we'll be able to contain.
I want to bring in Betsy McKay of the Wall Street Journal. Betsy, I must say, as a reader, you've done some marvelous stories in the Wall Street Journal on this subject, and I've been following you for a while now. And one of the things you mentioned in the Wall Street Journal this morning, I asked the question of Dr. Shah, that for all of his defense of how vigorous the U.S. has responded, there are a lot of people think that this outbreak did not generate the kind of international response in the beginning that we're now seeing today. What's your best take on this? How and why was the response slow?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, it was Dr. Shah was right that this was, that it was unlike, even from the start, it was unlike previous Ebola epidemics. Previous ones have been contained, to a certain local area. They haven't spread far beyond that. They've usually been in rural areas. But this one was different from the start, and that's the reason that everybody should have paid attention to it. When we looked back, we found that people on the ground, like Doctors Without Borders, which sent a team in or started putting teams in place in March, were already saying back then this is an unprecedented outbreak. So, Mike Osterholm is right. We can, hindsight is 20/20 or whatever. But it was, it's been many months. So even without recognizing it in the first few weeks, there should probably have been a recognition earlier on. You know, at one point, someone else on the panel can correct me, but I think it was in May. At one point, there was a feeling that the epidemic was the outbreak. was wrapping up. You know, the number of cases was declining, and it looked like things were slowing down. And that, you know, we now know tragically was an enormous mistake, because by June cases were growing. By the end of June, Doctors Without Borders was saying, you know, this is really out of control. And then we know what happened from there.
And what's your take about how and why the American government, after modest responses, is now going all in today? This question that Dr. Shaw stressed of affecting America's own interests and security. Is that really what happened, that people realized that that this was not just an outbreak in a distant region, but one with much larger implications?
Well, I think that's what always motivates us. On the other hand, the U.S. plays a very significant humanitarian role in the world. And, you know, I think he is right in saying that beyond the disease itself, which is reason enough to go in, you do have a very powerful argument for the possibility that there will be social breakdown and economic collapse, or certainly economic issues. And so that is a national security problem for us. So yes, I do think that's a major motivating factor. I will say that for several weeks, you know, public health experts, humanitarian aid experts have been calling for more involvement from the U.S. Because there was really no coordinated effort on the part of the actors involved to date. And there, you know, more and more, particularly as aid started coming in, you know, then there was really a need to coordinate it. And the U.S., the U.S. is traditionally the leader in these sort of things, and we're highly valued for our military, which, you know, as you know, has this ability to command operations and conduct logistics, you know, bring their logistics expertise, which is what's really needed right now.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I want to give the panel a chance to answer this question. And first, Dr. Oosterholm, is this going to work? Is this intervention enough? Is it robust enough, aggressive enough to check this outbreak, which, as a number of you have said, is really different from any other previous outbreak? What do you think?
Well, first of all, let me congratulate the U.S. government for stepping up in what is truly a major change in its position on how to deal with this. But, you know, let's face reality. This virus is in three countries, primarily in West Africa. The U.S. effort right now is focused primarily on Liberia. It's kind of like fixing one of your three screen doors in your submarine. Unless we actually can bring a region-wide response to Sierra Leone and Guinea, too, we're going to have a problem in terms of it continuing to leak back into Liberia. Now, this is a good start, and it should be a wake-up call that we need all the other countries of the world to help us make this a regional response. The second part of it is that the U.S. is going to be building a number of Ebola treatment centers and then turning them over to the Ministry of Health, which then may turn them over to NGOs, non-governmental organizations, et cetera. It's unclear how that's going to work yet. And so that we need to understand that when you look at the model, for example, of Doctors Without Borders, they have done it very well, where they handle everything from start to finish and have a very tight command and control over all that goes on. So we need effective Ebola treatment centers to be set up. It's not just setting them up. And that is still yet to be worked out. The third thing, if I could just say, is the fact that we still have a matter of time. You know, we've been talking about all this help that we're going to do, and Betsy's paper did a story recently on looking at what was actually promised and what's actually been delivered. And this is like a major burning fire. We need to have all the trucks on the scene right this hour, not next week or next month or next quarter. And so how fast this response occurs is also going to be important.
Sure. Dr. Malunga, let me ask you that same question. Is this going to be sufficient, given your experience, or is it not enough or too late?
Actually, what works is a five-component strategy. I think the U.S. is going to help with one of the components, which is logistics. But we need, as I said first, information and communication, a second very central part of the game. And early diagnosis, we need to give Africa the possibility to make early diagnosis of the disease, because the virus is going to stay in the area. And then the provision of care to patients, I think it's important, but the most important component is the prevention of transmission. And that can only be done at the community level.
Dr. Goodman, what's your take on this question?
Well, I really resonate on those last points. I think that the logistics, the healthcare capacity, the training capacity, the gear that the U.S. military can bring in can be decisive, but only if it is connected to the country and the communities in a culturally appropriate and sensitive way, and the communications.
This question of
robust.
Trusting the yeah. information, trusting the advice
right.
is central to efficiency.
Yes, and I think this is one thing about the response that hasn't been said. It really, for this to work, like the president of Liberia has to request the U.S. to come in there. We couldn't just go in a month ago without that kind of request.
That's Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. We'll be back with your phone call, so stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. By Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, 6 years ago, he was dispatched to Mauritania to reverse a coup. Now, the former top U.S. diplomat to Africa has turned his experiences into a political thriller. An insider's look at the workings of Washington and foreign policy making. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the president's announcement coming any time now of a major new U.S. effort to help combat the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Dr. Malunga Miyatudula is with me. He's formerly with the World Bank, as well as Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University on the phone. Betsy McKay has been covering this subject for the Wall Street Journal. And from Dallas, Dr. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota. And I have some emails I want to read. This first one comes from Gretchen. Why is it always the U.S. that is called upon to fix world problems? And then the U.S. is faulted for not doing enough, for not doing it fast enough. Why not hand the burden to France or China or Argentina or Russia or Spain? Jesse Goodman.
Well, I think many people ask that question. I think one reason is the a capability of the U.S. Another reason is the generosity and humanitarian nature of our people, who often will support these kind of activities. But it's a good question. And I think this is a teachable moment in global public health. And I think there needs to be almost an after action about this once we've got this hopefully under control. It is a ludicrous situation in my mind that the health of nations in the world depends on non-governmental volunteer organizations, depends on a WHO, which is chronically underfunded and has very
little... That's the World Health Organization.
World Health has very little authority. So I think we need to look, if we want to have a world where the U.S. isn't constantly in this role, which isn't good for these countries either, we need to have a world that builds global health security and infrastructure.
And isn't this also an example of how not only do viruses know no borders,
right,
but travelers know no borders, and that one of the things that's happening that threatens to increase the spread of this is it's reached Nigeria, which is a critical transportation hub in West Africa.
Well, you know, I think as Dr. Shaw said, there are very legitimate national and regional security issues for dealing with this. But underlying this, you know, we shouldn't have horrendous levels of preventable disease and death. You know, and we shouldn't have a global governance system which can't respond to that. So I think we need to support other countries to, it's like the teacher person to fish. We can't always do the fishing and we have to teach them. There's the U.S. advanced what's called the Global Health Security Agenda, which offers with its partners to build capacity throughout the world. I think we need to support that so people can solve their own issues.
We have a number of callers and questioners who raise this issue similar to John, who writes to us from Dallas, Texas. China has recently been a big investor in Africa and has a significant stake in Africa's flourishing. Why wouldn't the Chinese be a major partner and contributor to the renewed American efforts to stop the current outbreak? Betsy McKay, what is the Chinese role here?
Well, I'm glad somebody asked about that, because I think one of the big issues here, you know, with the U.S. plan, which is great, is, you know, there are two issues. One, how fast is it put in place? Because, you know, this, even if it's put in place tomorrow, it's going to take a while to start getting this under control. The second is, what is everybody else going to do? And where have they been in the first place anyway? So it's interesting that today, WHO, World Health Organization, said that the government of China has dispatched a mobile lab and is sending teams of experts to help with the, you know, with teams of epidemiologists and clinicians and nurses. So they're stepping up. Cuba is sending a large team of doctors. I mean, countries are starting. We're hearing of other countries doing more. The European Union has made a big commitment. But it is a good question, you know, and it'll be interesting to see now what other countries do now that we are taking this leadership role.
And here's a question from Tamron. Dr. Osterholm, perhaps you can take this one, because she also asked a question that we've gotten from several listeners. At the risk of sounding stupid, she writes, how exactly do U.S. healthcare workers get the free time they need to fly off to Africa for a few months? Last time I checked, my local doctors, especially primary care physicians, were quite busy and already seemingly short-staffed. Is there some sort of sabbatical program that U.S. physicians, and of course this is not just physicians, it's other kinds of healthcare workers, nurses and others, have access to that the rest of us don't know about? How would this work? Do you have a sense?
Sure. Well, just following up with what Dr. Goodman just said, in fact, this is an amazing response of volunteers and NGOs, non-governmental organizations. A lot of these people are not getting paid. They literally are taking time off to go do this just because of the humanitarian concerns that they have. So it varies by individual going, but a lot of people are volunteering time. And I think that's the important message. I do think that following up on the previous question, though, however, one of the concerns that I have is the more of the other donors countries enter into this area, who is going to be in charge? What is the command and control? Are the Russians and the Cubans and the Ugandans and the Chinese and the Japanese and the Canadians and the European Union people all going to work with us in a way that we all agree who's in charge? Because when everyone's in charge, no one's in charge. So one of the areas I think that is still very critical is the United Nations really does need to actually put together a structure for command and control. They don't have the resources, they don't have the expertise to do this, but they surely can empower a command and control structure with all these other different countries that are going to be sending support to the scene.
Dr. Malunga, you're nodding when you, Dr. Osterholm's comment. You agree that this question of coordination with so many different national groups is critical.
Oh, yeah. That is what I got from my first experience, because in 1976, yes, we had the CDC Atlanta, the Americans came, South Africans came, the French came, the Belgians came, and the Zairean. And one of the questions that the minister asked, who is going to coordinate? So unless you have a coordinator, you are going to create chaos. And chaos is going to help the spread of Ebola.
Let me go to some callers here. And
Could I just a minute.
We really need to get to some of our callers. And Samuel, you're on the line. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Happy to have you on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. Well, it's not a question. It's a statement more so to, not to the panel, but to people that have families back home. Because I am from Sierra Leone, but I came here as a little boy. But, you know, the first time I called my mom and told her, you know, make sure people back home are okay, they really believe that it's either it's a plague from God or something like that, or some even in the communities here, believe it or not, believe that this disease was cooked up in America, sent to Africa just to experiment on us. And it makes people there, if the information getting to them, they believe in those conspiracy theories, it makes them not even believe the disease even exists. They really think it's just somebody trying to lie to them or something. And that would help a lot if they just believe in the science and follow what doctors are telling them, because that's a major part of this disease. If the information that they believe in is not the science that they're told, then they're really not going to take it serious when family members get sick, because they just think it's some type of make-up disease, or they're just trying to get rid of us or something. We have to educate people there, let them know there. Follow the science, follow whatever you're told, and it will help stop the spread of the disease.
Samuel, thank you very much for that call. Very helpful contribution. Dr. Malunga, we were talking about this question of trust, and here the caller reflects it directly. How do you deal with the misinformation, the distrust, the mythology that Samuel was talking about?
The only way you deal with that is by talking with people. My mentor, was from a physician from California, told me that, Miat, if you want to succeed in Africa, you have to go into villages, sit down with the elders, talk. You have to build trust. So unless you build trust, these misinformation are going to stay. So we are going back again to this problem of communication, meaning it's not educating people, it's communicating, it's exchanging ideas. You can start with the information that I have, that okay, this virus was cooked somewhere or it came from God. But when you talk, after a while, if you know how to communicate, people are going to change.
You're nodding, Dr. Goodman.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think also those people can have some of the best ideas for how to then control this disease. They know what people are really doing. They know the behaviors. They know how to influence people. One thing some of us have talked about, and colleagues from Liberia, is enlisting Ebola survivors in the effort to control the disease. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are being shunned by their communities but can help their communities.
They also can contribute blood.
Well, we don't really know if that works, I have to say, but that's right. One comment I was going to say about the coordination that Mike Osterholm made and we all agree on is I think that coordination is also needed to assure that everybody who goes in is practicing sound, culturally competent communication. Because if people go in there without communication, they can undo what others are doing.
I want to turn to Anselm in Carmel, Indiana, who is originally, if I understand, from Nigeria and wants to get on this very subject. So welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Anselm?
Exactly what the previous caller had said is what I was trying to imply, that we need to empower the people in West African region through education and proper information so that they will be able to manage and control the spreading of this disease. It's a very complex but simple way to control it. But we have such a belief in West Africa that only people down there can really explain it to them how we can break the spreading of the disease across the whole place. And for America or anybody to think that it's an isolated thing, it is no longer an isolated thing. I came from Nigeria. I traveled to Nigeria. I came back here. The person who brought it to Nigeria came from Liberia. He's an American. He sent it to Nigeria. He could have brought it back to the U.S. here. The same thing happens all over the continent. So that is my contribution to it.
We're grateful for the contribution. Thanks for calling us here on the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Osterholm, your reaction to Anselm's call.
You know, as much as I talk about command and control in terms of the logistics and the medical treatment, and I think what Dr. Goodman said was right on the mark also about the need to assure that our messaging is right, but also just to assure that the quality of medical care is good. Think about this. Doctors Without Borders has not had one healthcare worker become infected while there. Meanwhile, we have over 320 healthcare workers from all the other NGOs or government programs that have become infected. That often is a marker for the quality of what they're doing, meaning that people are getting infected from breaks in good infection control. What else is happening? We need to ensure the best quality of medical care, of infection control, et cetera. We can help do all of that, but in the end, it's West Africans saving themselves from this situation. We need to listen to them. We need to understand from their leaders how best to do it. We just need to provide the tools so that they can do it, and that's what's going to bring this one to an end.
Let's turn to Nancy in St. Louis, Missouri. Nancy, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you and good morning. Along with what you're saying about the command and control in country, my concern and my questions are about here in the United States, we're part of the World Health Organization Treaty. And the things that got, I responded to Haiti. And one of the things.
You're a registered nurse, if I understand correctly, right, Nancy?
Yes, okay. I am. And I did logistics in Haiti, and one of the problems we ran into was people who thought they were doing good in the United States sending stuff to a disaster area. And they sent things that were, we had one person who sent eye implants, retinal implants that expired in the 80s. And then one person, another healthcare group sent an antiquated CT scanner. And these things were burned on site or they were dumped into the ocean by the Haitians. And so my concern is, do we have anything here in the United States to control this stuff being sent to countries and preventing it from going? What can we do onshore to stop this, all this stuff being sent to these countries that needs to be controlled? What can we do?
That's an excellent question. Betsy McKay, do you have an answer here? I mean, this there are so many different countries wanting to help, but the potential for chaos is obviously very real.
Yeah, well, I think one of the problems so far has been that there hasn't been this outpouring of desire to help because people are scared. That will obviously change now, or it may change with the U.S. going in and with more of this, you know, kind of official level help going in. You know, I think healthcare workers will be more interested in going if they feel like they really are going to be protected and not just taken care of if they get sick, but that they're not going to get sick at all. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think this is a very so you could start to see more, you know, NGOs and people wanting to help. This one, you know, this this outbreak, this event, humanitarian event, is a little bit different. I mean, you can't have just anybody go bringing anything. You have to go through specialized training to go and help in an outbreak like this. I mean, taking care of Ebola patients, as you all know, is a very specialized type of work. You have to learn to wear protective gear. You have to learn how to know, operate in it and so forth. So I think things will be different, but I'd be interested to know what others think.
Well, we have just a minute or two. I want each of you to sum up here, starting with you, Dr. Goodman. What's the outlook here? What can we expect in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, I think we can hope to expect a very quickly mobilized, ramped-up U.S. response that connects well with the people of Liberia and their ability to communicate with each other, and begins to bring that disease under control. I hope that will be part of an inspiration for a much broader international response, and that will be well coordinated and well managed. But I fear that many, many thousands of lives are going to be lost, and I do not want to lose the opportunities as we bring this epidemic under control to better be able to prevent and respond to future ones, whether it's figuring out what treatments work, evaluating new vaccines, we have some exciting candidates if it's possible, or just finally getting the message through that we need to invest in global public health infrastructure for our national security and for humanity.
Dr. Malanga, quick final word.
And I hope that this opportunity is going to give us the chance to go against one of the factor that makes these outbreaks. We have today to have Ebola, tomorrow we're going to have another outbreak, is the weakness of the health system. If this can really help our countries to have robust health systems, we are going to prevent these type of accidents in the future.
I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last word. Dr. Malanga Miyatudla from the World Bank. Also with me, Dr. Jesse Goodman from Georgetown, Betsy McKay, a correspondent with the Wall Street Journal, and on the phone from Dallas, Dr. Micah Osterholm of the University of Minnesota. I also want to thank Dr. Rajiv Shah, head of USAID, who joined us earlier in the broadcast. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and we're delighted to have you spend an hour of your morning with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk.